the Buddha, the Dharma, which is the Sangha. You hear Ramanola?
Yeah.
Okay. I have a hot pot here. This is my teapot talk. I almost did before I left for my few days out at the hermitage. But this is not the kind of teapot I had in mind, but any old teapot will do. Any old it's a hot water principle we're going to talk about here. But you're all familiar with these things. You know, you hit the button and you have water in it, and you know, water heats up and it boils, and you know, the steam starts coming out. Well, one of the frequently used metaphors in teachings on reharmonizing with the eternal is the metaphor of the steam, of the water turning to steam and the steam rising up to the eternal. And it's not, you know, of course, it's not literal water and literal steam, but the water and the steam are metaphor for what happens in the process of the conversion of karma. And the rising up is not a metaphor. That literally happens in the body and in the spirit. The rising up is experienced in the body is the rising up of the water, the spirit, you know, up the back of the body, in gratitude and in love, rising to the eternal. And in feeling, you know, it's experience of love and gratitude. The feelings of love and gratitude. Above all, you know, love and gratitude directed towards the eternal. But this doesn't begin in that state. It begins as the raw karma. It begins as greed, hate, and delusion. And then through the application of meditation and the precepts to that raw material of the karma, this transformation happens. And this is the greatest secret in the spiritual life. This is the great secret in the spiritual life. You know, I guess some people would say it's an esoteric teaching, but there's nothing really esoteric about it. Esoteric just means it's not visible to the worldly mind, and that's true. This is not visible to the worldly mind. And this is why you get more worldly attempts to explain the process, and they talk about, you know, trying to kill attachment or kill the self or get rid of. By getting rid of. But the deeper teachings don't talk in that way. They don't talk in terms of extinction and annihilation. They talk in terms of transformation, reharmonization, reconnecting, healing. So I want to talk about a few of the steps that people experience. And you know, this is not like some generic talk for some generic time. The talks never are. This is a talk for us at this time. And this is a time of real spiritual cooking where if you consciously and in a sensible way, in a grounded way, apply meditation to what is arising at the present time for you. Whatever it is, if you apply the meditation to it, if you apply the precepts, this is a time of wonderful opportunity for the deepening of the spiritual life. This is true for us as individuals, and it's true for us as a Sangha. But the choices that are made are not choices of groups of people, they're choices of individuals. You know, the essential spiritual choice is made by each of us individually. No one can make it for another person. And it's not a kind of group consensus that we all reach, you know, an agreement to proceed along these lines, one person at a time does it. It's always been that way. It always will be. Remember, thou must go alone. The Buddhas do but point the way. Rin Master quoted that so many times. And it's always true. So we start out with the raw material of karma down there in the hara. You're being kind of brought into the hara in meditation. And another way to think of it is it's bringing the raw material of the karma to the stillness of meditation, to the centeredness of meditation. And I just want to point out, as I talk about that stillness, that centeredness, that's not something we create ever. It's just something we connect with. And it's not just something that exists because we feel temporarily still and centered, because those feelings come and go. We all know that through our experience. You feel wonderfully still and centered at one moment and agitated the next. What happened? It's just feelings. They come and go. One set of feelings, one type of feelings replaces another type of feelings. So the stillness and centeredness I'm talking about is something deeper. It's right. It comes right from Buddha nature. It is part of Buddha nature, aspects of Buddha nature. And since what we call meditation is the opening of our heart to the eternal, to the Buddha nature, our choice to join the Buddha nature rather than just to spin our wheels in worldly excess of one kind or another, or in religious excess, so-called religious. In other words, because when we truly choose to walk the middle path, even if for a moment, and to withdraw within and reflect upon ourselves in meditation, pure meditation, then that connection happens. And that connection happens through our will, our choice, and through our willingness. But what that karma connects with there, what it joins with there, is not something created by you or me. It's greater than us. And this is an incredibly important point. This is why what I'm talking about is not storming heaven. It's just training in the ancient path of the Buddhas and ancestors that so many have walked before us. A path that can be walked by ordinary people. That does not rely on your becoming some extraordinary person. So you bring that karmic pain and confusion, that karmic need, to the stillness of meditation. And there, that's like when you have the water in the pot here, and it's cold, but you've got the water into the pot, and now you hit the button, and you turn it on. And now the cooking starts. You've got the key ingredients, Buddha nature, karma, bring them together in the hara, in the cooking pot, another one of the frequently used metaphors. Bring them together into the cooking pot. Cook that sucker. I don't know if I've seen it in the movies or what. I don't think I've ever seen it with my, actual physical, in person. But, they have like these big old, seafood cooks and the like, down in the Creole country, they have these great big pots and they throw everything into it. That's what I think of it as. In my mind, there's this big pot in the hara. There's this big space where this stuff can come together. And there the happy meeting can begin. That's where the happy meeting begins. Of our own longing, our own need, and the help of the Eternal. But I have to tell you now, it doesn't necessarily feel happy at this point. Because you know, when they hit that button and the cooking starts happening, you know, the heating up happens, well, it tends to, you tend to have kind of opened yourself to the feeling of the pain that's there. You know, I always use the words pain and confusion. Those are the terms that came up very precisely for me in my retreat in 1998-99, right at the beginning, pain and confusion. And it's that pain that it makes all the difference, see, if we'll turn and face it and open our heart to it and let ourselves feel it. It makes such a difference. Not hold it at arm's length, but let it be felt. It can't hurt you. I mean, well, it hurts, but it can't hurt what you really are when you do this. And every time you do it, you make a step forward spiritually, whether you know it or not. And your faith is strengthened. River Master used to sit there and say, I mean, I saw this in 76 when all hell was breaking loose in that monastery. And River Master sat there like a rock and she said, nothing can hurt you. Nothing can hurt the real you. Nothing can hurt you. Nothing can harm you. River Master Mokshin told me today, she's been having it come up, you know, don't go with the fear. And that's the same thing. You don't have to go with the fear. There is nothing to be afraid of. Of course, fear arises, but isn't that just another one of the painful feelings that one can bow to and bring into the heart and sit with? Sit still with it. I'm not going to pretend that this is always easy to do by any means. I know how difficult it is. And, you know, we support one another in this process. At any one time in the monastery, you know, one or two people may be going through the rawer part of the process, and other people may be in another aspect where they feel more secure and less raw. At that time, the groundedness and stability and certainty and faith of the people who are in the less raw state, you know, is like provided by the Eternal to help those who are struggling more. This is one of the incredible benefits of training in a mandala, which is what every true temple is. We all get our chance to do to be in each of the positions, and we all do our time in the heat of the cooker, and feeling the heat. As the cooking happens, the transformation begins. And it begins in ways that we can't see, that we just have to trust. We can't see it, we can't perceive it, we can't intellectually grasp it, least of all intellectually grasp it. We just have to trust that it's happening. It takes so much faith sometimes, especially when one of these chunks of the raw karma is particularly confused and particularly painful. And the two tend to go together, don't they? We all really know that from our experience. It'd be kind of comforting if the pain was separate from the confusion, so there was a great pain and no confusion at all, but it didn't like that. If you get whomped with both at the same time, so that, you know, that gives a great opportunity to doubt oneself. You know, another thing Ramesh used to say, you know, over and over again, don't look down. Don't go the route of doubt. Hold fast. Hold fast to the Lord of the house. Don't look down. Don't look down. Just keep looking. What is the next step? What's the next thing I need to do? Take that next step. That next step is just right in front of you. And the meditation just illumines what that is. You know, 2, 3, 4, or 5 steps down the road, the further you go in your mind down the road, the scarier it gets. Until people literally scare themselves out of the monastery sometimes. Literally. Terrify themselves out of the monastery. And out of training. Don't run ahead. It's another thing that came up over and over again in 98 and 99 for me and Ramesh Mokgen both. You can't run ahead. You've got to take it one step at a time. You've got to take what's here and deal with what is right in front of us, right at this moment. You don't know what's coming in the next moment. Deal with what's here now. Or you scare yourself. And the more difficult it gets, the more you scare yourself. I'll tell you an interesting thing I saw when I was out at the Hermitage. I ran across a wonderful book of the collected writings of Abraham Lincoln. And in one of the writings from the war years, he said, in a letter to someone, he said, I generally don't read the attacks on me in the press because there's nothing I can do about it. There's a wise man. And it's the same point I'm making here. I don't know if you recognize that. Don't go outside yourself to the opinions of others. Don't scare yourself with your own opinions. Just stay rooted in your own sitting place and attend to what is the next thing you really need to do. What the world thinks of you, what you think of yourself, what you might think of yourself in the future, what you thought of yourself in the past, these things don't matter. It's what we do now. Again, in 76, Ramesh wrote so magnificently, you know, don't worry about the past, don't fear the future, live now without evil. So this cooking's happening, and what is it that helps sustain the level of cooking that leads to the water vaporizing, the water going to steam and rising? What is it that does that? Now, I just tell you again that the water is a metaphor, and the steam is a metaphor, but the rising is not a metaphor. There is that which rises to the eternal, and one can experience this. One does experience it. Everyone who does this truly one day experiences this. And after that, then the gate is open to experiencing it again and again. It's not a metaphor, this part, the rising. But what is it that enables this sometimes amazing crud to become enlightened and to transform into something magnificent and something of utter purity? there has to be a sustained effort. And if I could use the analogy of someone who's training to, say, run a marathon or some long distance, if you were to go out without having done proper training and try to run that long distance, you'd just fail miserably. You know, you'd, even if you succeeded in making the distance, you'd destroy your body in the process. You know, you have to have done the training that makes it possible. And that training consists of day after day of a sensible, well-directed effort. You know, an effort that isn't excessive. Because in an excessive effort, you just exhaust yourself and then sink back into kind of despondency. And it's also not an effort that is just utterly haphazard and piecemeal and uncommitted, because that ends up kind of going all over the place and not really accomplishing anything. What there has to be the, what Rev. Matthew used to call the 55-mile-an-hour training. Just doing the speed limit, not going faster than the speed limit, not going slower. She used to say, and I love this, that's the true asceticism. In other words, that's the hardest thing to really do. And that's what we aspire to in our in the way we follow a monastic schedule, in the way the monastic schedule is laid out. To try to train in such a way that it's doable by every person in the community. Each, you know, each in their own way. There's a lot of variety in a community like this, where you have someone who's almost 90, and people who have who are dealing with serious illnesses as well, a kind of chronic illness, and then people who are relatively healthy, people who are older, people who are younger. No one in this present community who's really young anymore, but that could change one day, maybe. But the point of that schedule is not that you be a good person and follow that schedule and kind of get your merit badge. 1 year following the schedule, you know, 1 star. 2 years following the schedule, 2 stars. 3 years following the schedule, 3 stars, and so on until 5 years, letter of commendation. You know, that's not what it is. What we're trying to do is follow a schedule that helps us be a spiritual success, and in the process internalize what that schedule really means, which is what that schedule really means is that there is a natural going in and going out, a natural ebb and flow of the spiritual life, a drawing within, a natural being drawn within, a couple times a day, and a natural going back into activity. And of course, it's more complex than that, much more complex than that. But that's, you know, one good simple way to talk about it. So, not surprisingly, our main meditation periods in morning and evening during that that corresponds pretty naturally with most people's natural drawing within periods. Do you see what I'm saying? That the aim of the schedule is to help you do something that's natural to you, not to impose something upon you that can be a kind of hurdle that you leap in order to become more virtuous. Do you see what I'm saying? It's all the difference in the world. Because once you get it, then you can listen to your own body, your own spirit, for when you're being drawn within, and you can follow that call within. And you can listen for when you're being told, drawn back out, and follow that. This is what Dogen was talking about when he talked about treating your body and mind with respect, with reverence, really. You know, we train with the body and with the mind. We're not in a war against them. And I'm, of course, I'm not saying it doesn't take effort. You know, to go back to my metaphor, obviously, if someone's going to run a long distance one day in a race, say, then their training is going to take effort. And I used to, maybe one of the reasons I used that metaphor is I was a distance runner when I was a kid. And believe me, those workouts were murder. Although they're what I really enjoyed. I loved the workouts, but they were a grind. You know, you'd have different things on different days, but there wasn't any workout where you didn't push yourself hard. And they were doable, and they helped you make progress. And every year that I ran, I got faster. My times got better. I wasn't a great runner by any means. But that's not the point, is it? Is that I improved. And this happens in our meditative life. I'm talking about this because that sustained effort, it has to be a sustainable effort. And it has to be an effort. It has to be sustainable and an effort. You know, excessive effort is not sustainable. Laziness is not effort. And this is a time when each of us, you know, forget about the schedule of the monastery. Each of us has to be responsible for keeping our nose to the grindstone in the right way for ourselves. I learned this early because I learned this in 76 myself when I was right up against it. And it was I'm sure it was a big question in the minds of some of the seniors of whether I was going to be able to stay in the monastery. It certainly, if I'd let myself think about it, it would have been a question in my mind. For a while it was, but then I got beyond that. And I have no idea what Reverend Master made of what I was doing. But I'll tell you, I was meditating like crazy, round the clock. Whatever I was doing, I was working as hard as I could to meditate. And I took a seething mess and cooked it in the classic period of about 3 months. There was a preliminary period of about a month in which the cooking was pretty haphazard. And then there was a period of steady, clean cooking for 2 months, and then I had a Kensho. And it was a tremendous effort of will, but it was a sustainable effort. I could sustain it indefinitely, and I simply forgot about the past and the future and just sustained it day to day. And Reverend Master just watched me, and when the moment was right, she was able to help me. But I had to do the cooking. You know, for any one of us, at any point in our training, but especially at a time like this, we can have a considerable wad of stuff come up that is just sticking and isn't going to leave us be. It's got our nose right up against it. And that's where we really get to choose whether we will really put the meditation and the training into practice. Really put the precepts into practice. Because it's amazing how the precepts come into play here. Because, you know, where is it that our mind wanders so often? So often it wanders into complaining. So often it wanders into finding fault with others. Or with ourselves, for that matter. Because all fault-finding really originates in finding fault with ourselves. So often it wanders into a kind of a quagmire of doubt. And what is that but drinking the wine of delusion, really? And this effort that I'm talking about is however many times one gets caught, one catches oneself and goes back to just the meditation, just the next step, just the next thing that needs to be done. One brings it back into the hara. You know, the metaphor of the cooking in the pot is in some ways a little bit simplistic, because dang, what's in that pot keeps trying to jump out some of it. And if we can forget about the past and the future and just train this way indefinitely, day in and day out, then the cooking does happen. And when all conditions are right, then the water starts to flash into steam. I wanted to have for this talk, you know, like one of these teapots that actually whistles, because that's what I think of when I think of this, you know, that the whistling starts, you know. And that's when the gratitude starts flowing. And the heart really has softened, and the love of the eternal, the certainty of the eternal. There is to know this immense joy leaping up in one's whole body and spirit, leaping upwards. There is the unborn, uncreated, unformed, undying. The immense, indescribable joy of it. There is liberation. There is that which lies beyond the opposites, that which lies beyond birth and death. And it can be found right within samsara. It has to be found right within samsara. That's where we're living. The last thing I want to talk about is just the patience that this requires. You cannot be results-oriented. One has to drop that early in the process. If you're looking that I'm going to cook this stuff to get rid of it, forget it. It won't work that way. It'll be after you again and again. You're not going to get rid of self. Their master used to say, you can't tear the lotus up by the roots, tear them out of the mud and have the living plant still. There's always going to be that mud. Another way she put it was, later in her life, she'd frequently say, you know, our past karma can always act upon us, at least potentially. So don't think in terms of, I'm going to get rid of the problem and then I'm going to be happy. There's something much better than happiness being offered here. And, you know, it's the kindest Kanzan who appears in hell. We're going to get our toes held to the fire periodically, and that's all there is to it, and it ain't going to stop. It won't be all the time. It's going to be some of the time, and you never know when it's going to happen. Each time it happens, we get to choose again. Will I apply the meditation to this? And each time you successfully do that, you know, you developed confidence. Yes, this can be done. This can be done. And that's where you get those bodhisattva vows from. However innumerable the passions may be, I vow to transform them all. Think of that. The true bodhisattva vow, of course, more than any can be expressed in any words. But it's that uprising willingness, unconditional willingness. That's the true vow. That uprising, unconditional willingness. The big yes.